Thank you, Rick, for those kind words. My name is Joan, and I'm an alcoholic. Probably the most important words I've ever said in my life. I sobered up in Thousand Oaks, California. I have a sponsor. I sponsor, and my sponsor has a sponsor. My sobriety date is February 19th, 1975. I was 36 years old when I got sober, and I remember people saying at that point, if you own your own home and you have two cars in the garage, then you probably have more drinking to do. And I hated that. I just hated that. Thank God I was ready. And I don't like to hear those things. I don't like to hear, well, you're too young or whatever. Because when you're ready, you're ready. And I just don't like that. Anyway, got that out of the way. I grew up in Nutley, New Jersey. Spent most of my adult life in California, actually. I'm a widow. We were married 60 years. My husband preceded me in sobriety. He had 12 more days than I had. But who the hell is counting? He died sober. He didn't know he was sober, but he suffered with Alzheimer's disease. And that's why I moved here in March of 2017. I could no longer take care of him, and I have two children here, two daughters and three grandsons, and I decided it was time for me to be near my family, especially under the circumstances, and so I moved here. And I want to thank this community for how you welcomed me. I so appreciated it. We arrived on a Tuesday, placed Bob in Autumn Leaves Memory Care on Wednesday, and Thursday night I was at the Thursday night Hillside meeting. And someone said to me, you went so soon. And I said, I didn't dare not go. Mm-hmm. I didn't dare not go because I knew under the circumstances that if I didn't go right away, chances are it would take me a while before I got to a meeting. And I needed to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I first sobered up, and everyone is told this, I'm no different, that you can't keep it unless you give it away. And I want to thank this community for giving it away, because you sure did to me. And when I was in Florida, I moved here from Palm Coast, Florida, and my home group was actually Way Out Group in St. Augustine. This is a we program. You know, I could never stay sober alone. I would make all kinds of declarations, especially, with my husband, because, beer cans were flying off the wall, arguments, he was taping me to prove to me I was drunk, and I would make these great resolutions, that's it, I'm not going to drink anymore, and by 4 o'clock that afternoon, I'm drunk, and thinking, how the hell did I get here? I could not stay sober until I walked through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you taught me how. And I am so grateful, and I am so blessed. And that, this community is unlike any I have ever been involved with. It is just amazing. And I just want to mention this. The last 5 years when I was taking care of Bob, that community held me together. That community had, whenever I went to a meeting, and we were going to meetings all the time, five, six meetings a week, I was able to breathe because I had hundreds of eyes were on him, and I never had to worry, and that was my relief. So, this, if you're new, coming back, please stick around. It's given me everything. I started drinking when I was 15, and I was dating my husband. before he passed, we were married 60 years. And that's kind of unusual because we stuck together, you know, through thick and thin. We stayed together. And we were at a social event. He was in college. I was not. I lied to him when we started to date. He was 18. I was 14. He'd be in jail today. And, you know, my mother said, well, I wouldn't let you date Bob, only that, you know, he lives across the street. We had summer cottages at the Jersey Shore. And because she knew him, and I thought, surely you have forgotten when the cops pulled up and took him away. She never mentioned that. Anyway, that was unrelated to alcohol, actually. Anyway, we were at a college dance, and I was feeling awkward and out of place, and they had snuck in. It was Seton Hall University, which is a Catholic university, and there was no booze on campus, absolutely no booze. And what they had done, his fraternity brothers had poured the alcohol in the big soda bottles. And, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And I knew instantly that alcohol would do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And how I knew that, I don't know. I did not grow up in a house with alcohol. My parents were not alcoholics. I have a younger brother. He is not an alcoholic. The only time I remember alcohol being served was for special occasions, Christmas, Thanksgiving, a birthday, whatever, and Dad would make one container of whiskey sours and itty-bitty whiskey sour glasses, and maybe there was a swallow. You would need 670 of those things in order to get a buzz. And that was the only alcohol that I remember in my house. So why me? I don't know. You know, it is what it is. I grew up, and I'm the alcoholic. Anyway, I got drunk the first time I drank, loved it, loved to be drunk, absolutely loved it. And if you've got a really good buzz and it's midnight and you want to continue to drink and you know that you don't have much left in you, vomit. Because then I would know that I could drink more. And I was, you know, that's the way I drank. Had horrendous, horrendous hangovers. And I remember one time putting Alka-Seltzer in my scotch and water, thinking that that would take care of the hangover. It doesn't work. Yeah, it doesn't work. Anyway, that's the way I drank. You know, I woke up in my own vomit on the crushed gold new carpet. This was in California, and I had had, I don't know how much wine I had had the night before, a couple bottles of wine, whatever, and my only thought was, I'm never going to drink wine again, and that was my answer to everything. I can remember we had company, and I decided to grill filet mignon. And so we started out, you know, you start out the afternoon at noon with Tom Collins. I don't know if any of you young people know what a Tom Collins is. So you start out with Tom Collins, and then you go to beer, and then, you know, you go to, then it's dinner time, and you have at least four or five bottles of wine with dinner. No, I forgot the martini beforehand, vodka martinis, which, you know, that. Just the first sip, and you just feel it all the way to your toes. It's wonderful. And that was followed by the wine with dinner and scotch and water afterward, which was my drink of choice, was scotch and water. And I can remember I just lost my cookies. I just lost my cookies. And my immediate thought was, I am never going to do that again. Next time, I will grill hamburgers. So that's a hint. Don't cook anything expensive if you're drinking. I'm all over the place here tonight, but it's the way it's going to be, I guess. We were married in 1958, and he was 23, I was 19, and we had a child. Our first child was born the day after our first year anniversary, a son, and I remember my mother saying, "Thank God." He was early, but he wasn't that early. She said, "Thank God, now that my friends won't think you had to get married." And that was her, that's what she was afraid of. Anyway, and he brought him home from the hospital. In those days, you stayed in the hospital for at least a week. I loved it. You know, I didn't want to go home, take care. I had this thing that they put in my arms to take care of. I didn't know what the heck to do with them. And so they, you know, we stayed in the hospital for a week, and they brought the baby to me, and then they took him away, and that was fine. You know, just take him to the nursery, that's fine. I'll sit here and read and smoke, because in those days you could smoke in the hospital. And I wasn't, he was about 2 weeks old. We were living in an apartment, and I left the infant alone because I needed to go get my stuff. And I remember telling the neighbor next door, you know, I'm going out, and would you please listen for the baby? He was 2 weeks old. And then there were two children. 18 months later, our daughter was born. And then I left both of them alone to go out and drink in the bar. I mean, you know, if you run out of booze at night and you know that bar is still open, I'm going to go to the bar. I'm not going to worry about who's going to take care of my two children. And then when there were three children, the three of them were left alone. That's how irresponsible, that's how much alcohol dictated my life. I needed it, and I went and got it. And I remember coming home from the bar thinking, oh my God, I hope those children are okay. And my next thought was, what will the neighbors think if they're not? Selfish and self-centered to the core. That's where the disease takes us. And that pattern continued until the day I got sober. I suffered with blackouts. I didn't know that I had blackouts until one morning the neighbor across the street came over and she said, "I'm sorry that I disturbed you last night." I don't remember her being there. And I thought, my God, what is that all about? Because I didn't know about blackouts. I didn't know about alcoholism. Not that that would have made a difference at that point. I just didn't know. All I knew was that if you wanted to have fun, you drank. Who the heck wouldn't want to? I loved to drink. I loved to be drunk. I just loved it. You know, it was in the late 50s and early 60s, and drugs were not any part of my story. I do remember taking a diet pill because I was told it gave you energy. And at 10 o'clock that night, I am coming off the walls. And I thought, I got drunk. I knew what would work. I started to drink. At that point, I wasn't drinking every day. I drank when I could get away with it. I didn't become a daily drinker until, I think it was around 1968. And I remember thinking it was maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and what the heck is going on? I'm craving a drink. I didn't understand. I did not know that was the disease. But that, you know, that didn't bother me at all. I just got drunk. I got well on beer. That was my get well juice in the morning instead of orange juice. I would go to beer. And you've got two alcoholics, practicing alcoholics in the family. It's very difficult to keep track of all the beer. And so I finally realized that if I hid the beer in my daughter's closet, he would never go in there, and he didn't. And I would sit in this, you know, the closet's maybe this wide, and I would sit in the closet with the closet doors closed in my dirty pink bathrobe, which, by the way, was my uniform. You know, a little vomit over here and a safety pin holding it together. It was charming. And I would sit on the floor drinking warm beer because I didn't want him to have any of the beer. And he would really get angry if he came home from work. And his job, he was all over the clock. And so if he would get home at, say, 10:30, 11 o'clock at night and there was no beer, he was not happy with me. And that's why I had to hide it. You would too. I would say that, you know, beer cans, I remember we were married maybe 2 weeks home from the honeymoon. We only had a brief honeymoon because he had to go to work. I had to find a job. And beer cans are bouncing off the wall, literally bouncing off the apartment wall. And I'm thinking, what is going on here? He has a problem. And I hid behind his alcoholism until the women in AA made me face my own disease. He was the reason why I drank. He was the reason why I did the things I did. I always blamed whatever I was doing on him. You know, it was easy, and he didn't know. I told this story at, we had a memorial for Bob in St. Augustine a few weeks ago. And they wanted me to tell a story I had never told before about him. And so I told them, you know, you've got two practicing alcoholics in the house waking up the next morning hungover. We used to have a hangometer. Hungover. And he wants sex. Now, come on. There's no way that I'm interested in doing anything. I just want to lay in bed and try not to throw up. And so I would say to him, oh, honey, we did that all last night, all night long. And he was in a blackout, so he believed me, and he would leave me alone. So that's how I dealt with that situation. Anyway, he recognized that he was having a problem with alcohol. It was the Christmas of 74. It was that November. He recognized that there was something going on, and he stopped drinking. And I tell you this part of his story because it leads into mine. And he called a friend of ours who was going to AA. And Wynn said to him, I'll be right there. Wynn was doing what he should do. He was doing a 12-step call. And I'm thinking, yeah, finally, that son of a bitch is going to do something about his drinking. And so Wynn did his thing, you know, his 12-step call. And then Wynn turned to me and said, and when you're ready, Joan, here's the name of three women and their phone numbers. Call one of them. I thought, what the heck is he talking about? He's the one with the problem. I don't have a problem. I don't need this. Well, I sat Thanksgiving dinner with my head literally in the mashed potatoes at the table. And I did not want to ruin Christmas for the children. And so I called the number. I called June. And June picked me up and took me to a meeting. And in those days, she took me to three meetings, and she said, if you want what we have, you'll find us. And she cut me loose. I thought, great, I don't have to go to those meetings anymore. And I didn't. In February of 75, I escaped to Ohio, but by this time, Bob is sober, and he's really bugging me about my drinking. And I escaped to Ohio where my brother was living, and I drank. Now, what happened to me is this. During those three meetings, I heard, it's the first drink that gets you drunk. That was my spiritual awakening. When I drank that time, I knew exactly what you were telling me. I knew it was so. I knew that that first drink set up the compulsion. And I don't stop drinking until I'm done, whatever done looks like, and we don't really ever know what done is going to look like. But I knew that what you were telling me was true. Now, I didn't stop drinking while I was at my brother's. But I knew that I had a drinking problem. When I got home from Ohio, I remember it was a Thursday night, and I was sitting on the couch, and Bob was going out the door, and I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "I'm going to an AA meeting." And I thought, that son of a bitch is not going to leave me home alone with these three children. And I went. And I've been sober ever since. So I don't care what gets you through the door. Just get through it. Because I certainly did not have the right motive. I just didn't want to stay home with the kids. But that, guess what? It worked. And I've been sober. And that began my love affair with Alcoholics Anonymous. I avoided the women. Of course I did. Because the women will tell me the truth. You know, the men will think you're cute, whatever. And a lot of my self-worth, too, was tied up in that kind of thing, how attractive I was. That was my self-worth. But the women, you know, you're the ones that helped me identify my disease. You taught me how to be a wife. You taught me how to be a mother, a daughter, a friend. I knew I had not a clue how to do any of that. The marriage was a disaster when we both sobered up. It is because of Alcoholics Anonymous and the fact that I was taught that I was to clean up my side of the street. I couldn't blame, you women would not let me blame him for a damn thing. Pissed me off. You made me work on myself. And I was told that if he's doing what he's supposed to be and you're doing what you're supposed to do, you will walk the path together. And that's what happened. I never believed that marriage could be put back together. It was such a disaster. We both had indiscretions, to put it nicely, and we both knew about the other one. And, of course, I justified all my actions because, well, he did, so I will, and it's because of him and whatever. And you wouldn't let me get away with that. You just would not let me get away with that. And so we began, you know, we began the journey of Alcoholics Anonymous. It is unbelievable. I had strong sponsorship in the beginning. And when I was 3 years sober, Bob's job took us elsewhere. It took us from Southern California to Fargo, North Dakota, of all places. Can you imagine the shock? But Fargo is charming. I mean, it's not really what the picture tells you, the movie picture tells you about, but it was charming. I was 3 years sober. And my sponsor said to me at that point, she said, "Remember, you need Alcoholics Anonymous. They don't necessarily need you, so you keep your mouth shut. And whatever way they do AA there is the way they do AA there. And they don't want to hear how it's done in Southern California." And for some reason, I listened to her, and we've moved several times in sobriety. In fact, in the 80s, we were here when the Howe Place was on 92. It now has that huge spider on top, right? And I know. And look at you now. But that's where I went to meetings. We lived off Blackwell, off
Canton Highway,
yeah, in Heritage Farms. And in fact, one of the other gals in Woodstock lived in the same neighborhood. I think she moved in when we were moving out. But anyway, Bob was with CNN at that point. But I loved the Howe Place. I mean, that was a great place. We were talking about a railroad Bob, and oh God, who else? Anyway, I won't go into that. And our journey took us back to Southern California. But we lived in Indiana and Syracuse, New York, and his career took us to all these places. And so I learned AA is everywhere, you know. AA is everywhere, and you just have to make up your mind to accept the way it is at any given place where you live. The chapter, The Family Afterward, I remember my sponsor had me read that a lot. The kids were a mess when I sobered up. Our son just hated us. He was 15. Our daughter was 14. She was mothering the 10-year-old daughter. And quite honestly, I was okay with that for quite a while. Let her be the mother because I was not up to the job. You know, we slowly began to put the family back together, but I have to tell you, and I like to tell this, when I was 38 years sober, that's when our son finally forgave us. And throughout the years, he would disappear. He has his own disease, mind you, but that doesn't make any difference. That's his disease. But I would do what you told me to do, and I would reach out to this child. He was a teenager by that time. He was out on his own at the age of 18. He was hitchhiking from California to Oregon when he was 15. I would reach out periodically just to say I love you, just to say we're here. And finally, at 38 years of sobriety, I heard what he had to say. That's what I needed to do. I needed to hear him. I needed to hear his side of the story. And I listened. It was a phone call. And I listened to that child. He was not a child anymore. But I listened to my child tell me what it was like to be a child in that household. And for the first time, I was truly able to make the amend that needed to be made. And that was for him. And I needed to hear what he had to say. So if any of you, you know, if you're still struggling with members of your family, don't give up. Just never give up. There is always hope. And you know, I didn't believe it, but I just kept doing what you asked me to do. Thank God. And we have a pretty okay relationship today. It's not the best, but it's certainly better than what it was for all those years. I mean, they grew up in a house with two parents drinking and screaming. I mean, we entertained the neighbors all the time. I mean, you never knew which Scott was going to come out the door. And I, you know, he'd get in his little, he had a little red Mercedes, a two-seater. We had to sell it in order to pay bills. But, you know, at the time, and he would start driving away, and I'm holding on to the back of this little Mercedes, screaming. And so we entertained the neighbors greatly. And I can remember we would wake the children up around whatever time it was early morning, 12, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., whatever it was. We get the kids, gather them into the living room and say, okay, mother's leaving. Which one of you want to go with her and which one of you want to stay with me? Nice. And whomever would get in my car, and I'd start down the Ventura Freeway and thinking, what the hell am I doing? And then I turn around and go back and put the kids back to bed. So that's what they grew up with. I mean, I thought nothing of knocking on a neighbor's door at 10, 11 o'clock at night. If I'm out of booze and I know that you have some, you better believe I'm going to come knocking at your door. And thank God, you know, they would let me in. Why, I don't know, but they did. They let me in. And I would sit and drink your booze. And there's a story behind this one. I was recently in Palm Coast, the house that we sold in Palm Coast. I visited my neighbor next door, and I said, how are the women that bought the house? And she said, oh, I threw them out of the house. I said, why? She said, do you know that they would come over at 9 o'clock at night drunk, wanting to drink my booze? I thought, yes, that sounds familiar. She said, well, you know, Judy said, I had to go to the restroom. When I came back, she had gone through my cabinet, and she was drinking her Grand Marnier. How do you pronounce that? I never drank that, gang. I drank Ripple. It was 29 cents a bottle. That's the wine I drank. Anyway, and she said, I just threw her out of the house. And she said, the boyfriend was terrible. He would get drunk. He would pick fights with Wayne. I thought, my God, Joan and Bob moved in next door. You know? And Judy said, and of course, she broke my anonymity. Well, there was never an ounce of alcohol in that house. Joan and Bob were members of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next morning, the gal came over and said, well, I'm going to go to AA too. But she, as far as I know, she has not. So, yeah, you know, I just chuckled. I really did. God, you never know. Hopefully there's good karma in that house, and they'll get sober whether they want to or not, you know. I'll let you know. Bob and I used to drink at the Malibu cottage, which was on the ocean, the Pacific, and we would have to drive home through Malibu Canyon to Agora, where our home was. And I was driving this one night. It was that little red Mercedes. And we're arguing, because we're always arguing. And he says, stop the car. And I stopped the car. We're in the middle of the canyon. He said, and he got out. And he said, I'm walking home. And I said, good. And I pull away. And I leave him. And I go home. And the phone is ringing, and I just pick it up and put the receiver down. I mean, there were no cell phones or anything, so I don't know. He was calling from a payphone, and I just kept picking it up, putting it down. I passed out. And the next thing I know, it was a ranch. I have the jewelry box on the side of my head because he reached through the window and picked up the jewelry box, and that's how he woke me up. And, of course, you know, the argument commenced from there. And then he told me he had been picked up on, he was hitchhiking, he was picked up on the Ventura Freeway, and they're headed in the wrong direction on the Ventura Freeway, and this guy is putting a make on Bob. And Bob said, no, I'm not that way, let me out. So he pulled over on the freeway, let Bob out, and Bob somehow made his way home. True story. I'm 10 years sober, and I'm speaking in Santa Barbara, and I tell the story. And afterward, a man comes up to me, and he says, I was that man that picked your husband up. So you never know, you know? You just never know. Yeah, I mean, I've had a couple of things like that happen to me in meetings. One had to do with our son. We went away for the weekend, and he had an open house where everybody in town is invited. And there happened to be, maybe, I don't know, a couple years later, I'm sitting in a meeting, and I tell the story, and this young man says, I was at your house. I was at that party. We were 3 years sober when we were living in California, and we decided to have both sets of grandparents out for the holidays. They were both on the East Coast in New Jersey, and so first his parents came out. And our son was at that point living at home, and he had this girlfriend, and we were sitting at the dining room table. Bobby was not at the table. And I thought he was in his bedroom, and I thought I could smell pot. And so I went to his bedroom door knocked, and he, of course, said, come in, and I opened up the door, and he and his girlfriend are laying there in the bed. They were covered, smoking pot, and he had been warned that if he could not smoke pot in the house, and if he ever did again, he would have to leave. And so we asked him to leave. And it was quite a scene because, of course, Grandma and Grandpa don't really understand, and they're all upset. Okay. About a week after he's out of the house now. I don't know where he's living, in the hills, whatever. And I meet his friend in the post office, and he says to me, did you know that Bobby has crabs? I thought, oh no, because Grandma and Grandpa are now sleeping in Bobby's bed. Oh dear. So I called a nurse, and I was scared to death. I was embarrassed, whatever, and she starts to laugh when I tell her the story. She said, I've been there. I know exactly what you do. And so we did. We put the bed out in the, you know, in the sun and whatever, and I just kept praying, please, I don't want to have to ask Grandma and Grandpa to shave. That would not be appropriate. So Grandma and Grandpa never caught the crabs, we're happy to say. But that was our Walton Christmas, as I like to name it. And, you know, and again, I remember just running to the meeting. There was a ladies' meeting that morning, and I just remember running to the meeting, and I was just devastated and embarrassed. And you know, you all did the same thing. You all laughed, you know? And it's not anything that can't be dealt with. And you know, and that's so amazing. There isn't anything that happens that you cannot deal with through Alcoholics Anonymous. If it's the crabs, if it's a leaky pipe. I remember, you know, the basement in Fargo was flooded. I called my sponsor. I said, what do I do? She said, you call a plumber, stupid. But I needed to be told all of that. You know, I can't always think of what it is I am supposed to be doing. Thank God I can pick up a phone and get my ego out of the way when I get it out of the way and say, help me. I don't know what to do. This is the first time I've ever had anything like that. I've had a lot of firsts in the last 5 years, believe me. And, you know, I think I could not have done what I have done in the last 5 years without Alcoholics Anonymous, without the men and women who are there to support me, Bob, the rest of the family. It's just amazing to me. And you know, I don't know why I'm going to say this, but I asked for direction before I got up here. When Bob passed away, I had everything in order. That is not me. That's you. That's my higher power. Everything had been dealt with. Yes, there are the last-minute things you have to do. But I had put everything in order because people had came forward. They said, have you done this? No, go do it. Have you been here? No, go do it. I did it. So that part of the process was really made easy for me. And I am so grateful for that. I can't imagine. My sponsor said to me this morning, I'm having knee surgery on Tuesday, and you know, there were a couple of days that I needed help that I didn't quite know what to do about. She had a brilliant suggestion. She said, why don't you work the third step? I thought, wow, see, I never thought of that. I didn't. But I thought to call her, and I thought to get my ego out of the way, to say, this is what happened, and this is what I'm feeling. I need, and she, do the third step. guess what? It works. You know, it really works. And so the 2 days that I needed help have been taken care of. And she said to me, you just don't realize, you know, from the outside, watching the process go on. It is amazing to see the process continue. As long as you stay in the middle of the program, as long as you do, you know, you continue to do the steps. I realized when Bob was diagnosed that, yes, I had been doing the third step, but I needed to do the seventh step, because if I don't get my character defects out of the way, how the heck am I going to do the third step? I don't know, you know, the only character defect I know for sure that has been removed is my compulsion to drink. Other than that, they creep up in all kinds of forms that, you know, I'm thinking, really? How did you think to come up that way? So that, you know, that is the only thing I know for sure has been removed. The rest I work on, you know, continuing basis. I don't know if anything else has been removed. I'm better than I used to be. But, you know, I'm the last one to really know what I'm like. I really am. So, you know, to hear her say, to watch the process, I don't know, I just do what you ask me to do. And, you know, and the fear. My higher power gives me the strength to face my fears, whether I want to face them or not. And it's difficult sometimes to walk through the fears. But I know with this program and you people, I mean, my sponsor went to my first gynecological, whatever that is. Yeah, visit. I hadn't been in years. She went with me and held my hand. You know, took me to the dentist. Go figure that you would do that for me. But, you know, women have done that. They have walked me through this entire journey, and I am so grateful. Thank you for allowing me to come tonight. I'm going to shut up now. It's almost, well, you have a little bit of time. You can go home early. My sponsor always said, you end a meeting on time. Never forget this. Because you don't know who has babysitters that need to get home to their children. And I think that's being very respectful. So anyway, I will end. Thank you all for your patience.